Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out. It's only like 104 here in Phoenix, but cool in the bookstore. So thank you, virtual audience, for joining us as well. I'm really pleased to have a chance to talk to Mike Madden, whom I have known from your first thriller that you wrote for Putnam.
2013 Drone.
That's right.
It's been 10 years.
It has been. And we've been through your books and now Clancy books, and now we're in Custerverse.
Yes. I am growing up.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting that you can adapt to these different worlds, but there are lots of similarities in them.
Yeah. My first Drone series was a techno thriller series.
Right.
Of course, I, like everyone who loves the genre, you read Tom Clancy. And so when I was invited to join the Tom Clancy franchise, it was both the best day of my literary life and the single most terrifying literary day of my life. Because now, yes, I get to write a Clancy novel. Now I must write a Clancy novel. And the standards, of course, are extremely high. But it was just so much fun. It was a joy. I learned a lot. And then I had the privilege of being invited into the Clive Cussler franchise, which I was pretty sure I couldn't do because...
Really? Why?
The level of action... I mean, if you go back, I mean, I'm on... this is number 17, I believe.
You mean in the Oregon Files series?
Just the Oregon Files.
Yeah, right. I know. So, I've got the whole Cussler universe in my head.
There's five
right.
of them. I know. It's amazing. Right. And you look at the books, say, by... Boyd Morrison or Jack DeBrule, just in the Oregon Files now,
right.
You know, along with Clive. I mean, they wrote about everything, and every page is a page-turner. I mean, it's just chock full of rising big action all over the planet. It's really big stuff. And so that has been just a challenge and a joy to try to rise up to that level. And it's just been a blast. It's been a blast. So I feel like it's really pushed me as a writer to do better, to dig deeper and to find resources I didn't know I had. So I've loved it.
Well, one of the things you get to do in a Cussler book is you get to travel all over. So we'll get to this. I had to read your book in part with my phone because, you know, I'm not that familiar with Tajikistan and some of the mountains. So, you know, I learned a lot. Interestingly enough, our first mystery book for this month is a spy thriller by I.S. Berry called The Peacock and the Sparrow, and it takes place in Bahrain, which is the headquarters of the Fifth Fleet, none of which did I know. You know, so, I mean, one of the reasons it's fun to read these books is you can learn a lot.
Well, and the insider secret is I get to learn a lot.
Right, first.
Yeah, the presumption is I know these things. No, I have to go figure them out. I have to learn them. And it really is one of the joys of doing this. I'm constantly growing, as I said, as a writer, but just as a person. I'm learning about right. new issues, new places, new things. My wife and I love to travel. We love to go to as many of these places as we can. COVID, of course, set all that back. So we're trying to ramp back up into our travel schedule relatively soon.
I'm sorry you missed Tajikistan.
Yes, that's maybe the one I didn't get to this time. But, you know, there might be a Viking cruise there or something. Maybe there's an opportunity there. Who knows? But it's... the world's a big place. It's constantly changing. There's no shortage of conflict, unfortunately. And of course, right. conflict drives all story, comedy, tragedy, all of it. But certainly in action and techno thrillers, it's all about conflict. And there's no shortage of new wars and new technology. So that's kind of what I do as a writer. I try to stay up on these things constantly. And so when a new book opportunity rises up, there's plenty of material to draw from.
There really is. And I think that Boyd set you a fairly high bar because those of you who are Cussler fans will remember that Boyd's last two books, he sank the Oregon and then he
Thanks,
rebuilt
Boyd.
It.
Thanks,
I know.
Boyd.
But I mean, you know, that was, well, at least he left you with a ship, you know, he didn't make you rebuild it, but nonetheless, and that was really fun for Clive. It truly was. It was the last two books that they did together. And I think, you know, he really enjoyed that.
Boyd really can put a plot together. As a reader, I love it. As a writer, I hate it because I have to try to rise up to that level. I don't know if I do, but I certainly try to get next to it. And before him, Jack DeBrule also. Incredible plots. Just a almost a literary writer. I mean, Jack's prose was just phenomenal on the page. So to read those two guys and say, oh, now it's my turn.
Right.
But hey, who doesn't like a challenge?
So have you pretty much stuck to reading? Have you read the whole sort of, I mean, I've had 30 years to read it, so I'm 33 actually, so I'm way ahead of you. But have you focused on the Oregon Files in your reading rather than trying to read Graham's books and all the rest?
I'm staying focused on the Oregon Files. I've been all through them. I've got my own little Bible breaking things
right
out, have the basic story. But every single year, I just pick up the book and another book and go again. I'm just going to, there's so much in these books.
Mm-hmm.
I've read them. I know them. But I'll say, okay, I'll read another one. I'll read it again. And it's like, oh, he did that. Oh, that did what? And so I'm shocked and I'm thrilled all over again because there's so much. These things are so dense with detail and action and places. And so for me, just to stay in that universe and to stay current with what they've done so I don't step on their toes or step back into story or plot lines. But also it's inspiring. It really is. It's really inspiring to read these things and see what they've done, to see that they hold up. And then, you know, how do I put my spin on it? How do I take it in my own direction within that context?
So there's a finite number of places, really, that you can all go. So at some point, you're going to be in the same territory as some other Kessler book. But here's what I wrote about. Don't do that. I hate it when, you know, these damn phones, you touch them, and they're so lively, they just go away. But anyway, I said that you've outdone yourself here from the opening action scene where the Oregon Files lead actor, Juan Cabrillo, infiltrates a seemingly impregnable, held for ransom headquarters in Tajikistan to rescue a CIA asset in a scene straight out of a Daniel Craig James Bond movie. But what I want to know is, what's a held for ransom headquarters?
Well, you know, it's a place in Tajikistan. I think it's actually an Airbnb called Hell for Ransom.
Is this a place where you, like Guantanamo, basically, where you take people and put them to hold them for ransom?
Well, it is. There's an organization.
Well, that's not what Guantanamo does. Sorry. But no, you know what I mean.
But
sorry, U.S.
The presumption is that there is a crime family going back basically to the Medicis. That specialized in kidnapping and ransom. So it's an old family business. It's been around for several hundred years.
Okay.
And so they're expert at getting the very best people to kidnap, to ransom at the very highest price. So
okay, so when they have successfully kidnapped somebody, this is where they stash them while they're extorting whatever.
Exactly,
they're...
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're like the Sotheby's of kidnapping. Put it that way.
So the challenge for you then would be to A, build the fortress, and then B, figure out how anybody can break into it. And those are really kind of contradictory tasks.
Welcome to the life of the action writer. It's if you can build a trap that you can easily see a way out of, then you've not built a trap. So you've got to build a place you can't get out of. Then you get really excited. I have built this fortress. No one can escape. And then suddenly I'm sitting there staring at my screen saying, there's no way to escape this. So it's that constant tension.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's fun is you become the character. Like, okay, I'm here. How do I get out? How would I think about getting out of this? So, you know, one of the many secrets of writers is they're just like myself. I should talk about myself. I'm still an 11-year-old child, a boy. I'm looking to crawl out of, you know, the fort I made of sofa and bed sheets and climbing over fences I shouldn't be doing and throwing rocks at things I shouldn't be throwing rocks at. So I just get to live that out now as an adult on the page, basically. I just throw in high-tech weapons and supervillains.
Right. So, I mean, do you actually sketch it out? I mean,
very often, yes.
Seems to me it has to be kind of visual in order to make this work.
Absolutely. No. And I've done screenwriting in the past and still do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a visual medium. And so I've always brought a visual element to my writing. And I was doing that before I wrote novels. So I see things first. I always mm-hmm. see the scene before I write it. Certainly, I will sketch things out, draw plans, draw diagrams. And then my long-suffering wife, Angela, often finds herself in knife fights, gun fights. She has to duck around corners. She's chasing me. She's awesome, but because she'll read a scene and say, "Nah, it doesn't work." I said, "Sure it does. I wrote it." "Nah, it doesn't work."
Really?
And she'll be right. She'll be absolutely right. So we'll get out there and we'll wrestle around, mess around, and boom, we'll fix it.
And so you out in public view? You haven't been arrested or put into some kind of hidden fortress?
Well, we do most of this behind closed doors. Yeah, yeah.
He lives in an outdoor area. This is the reason I mentioned that. You could actually step into the mountains and tackle some of this.
Yeah, and believe me, we've been in some public places where we had conversations for sure. And yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, realism, I mean, it's ironic, right? I mean, fiction is making stuff up. But first of all, I always want to tell the truth in my fiction. In fact, fiction is probably the only place you can tell the truth anymore because of the world we live in now. But certainly, it's okay that the organ, I don't think actually exists, but if it's going to fire a weapon, it's going to, in my mind, has to conform to how that weapon would actually function. What would it actually do? What does a 120-millimeter smoothbore cannon do? How does it fire? How many shots in a minute? And so on and so forth. So though I'm a fiction writer, I'm constantly striving for reality. And that includes action, hand-to-hand combat, firing pistols. Fortunately, that also means fine food and beverage, which I think is an important aspect of research because I care so much about, well, the reader. So as often as not, if it tastes good on the page, it's because it's been well-researched. And that's my commitment to you.
That's extremely noble of you. I like that. You know, verisimilitude to a high
servant.
Level. Boy, no kidding. So, but basically, with all Custlers, there is a naval aspect to it. Clive was about ships, and the
Absolutely.
Oregon is a ship. So my question is, why is the Oregon crew in the mountains of Tajikistan?
Well, if you only told stories on the water, nothing wrong with that. A number of authors have built franchises around that. But one and the intrepid crew of the Oregon are not bound by something like water. They go anywhere they need to go, fight anyone they need to fight,
okay.
resolve
so
any
So they
issue.
Have other transportation. I mean, they
absolutely.
Don't have to be on the ship.
No, absolutely. And so, for example, one of the things that Boyd Morrison introduced was the tilt rotor aircraft. The military version is called the Osprey. I don't know if you know it, but it's where it can fly like an airplane or tilt the wings and it flies like a helicopter, which was a brilliant thing for him to do. So that's a very versatile vehicle. Right. So that's why they can go inland and do things. Of course, they've always had Tiny Gunderson, who is their fixed wing pilot who can fly them all over the world. And so they've always been in lots of places other than the water. But yeah, at some point you got to be on the water. And so that's awesome.
No, I know. I had this conversation with Dirk because the last Dirk Pitt, it opens up in Tibet. So the first thing I said to him was, how come we're in Tibet? And he looked at me and he said, because I knew you hadn't been there. Because we had some conversations about places he'd put books where I have been, and especially the Straits, the Bosphorus in the first one that he did was a little sketchy there. But anyway, so that question came up, you know, is what technology is useful? Why would Dirk Pitt and Numa, for example, why would they be in Tibet? And how would they be in Tibet?
Yeah, what I love about the Custlerverse generally is it's very tech heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the Oregon Files, extremely tech heavy. As a writer, that gives me lots of options. I can go up high, I can stay on the ground, I can go under the water, I can be on the
right.
water. So we talk about putting yourself up a tree that you can't get out of. Well, if suddenly here comes a drone that drops a rope, I can get out of it, kind of thing. So,
well, I do notice that drones tend to play a small role in your books, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, I can't get away from
it. Who can blame you for that? And they're getting more and more sophisticated and whatever. So, you know, you were doing drones 10 years ago, but they've come a long way now.
10 years ago, I was accused of writing science fiction, but everything I used in my original drone series was based on actual technology, either in, you know,
right.
that was deployed or on the books. now all those technologies are kind of silly compared to what we're actually doing. I mean, it's advanced so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the thing with the Clive Cussler franchise and really the book Flood Tide that introduced the concept of the Oregon, it was not, there was no Oregon Files yet. Clive mentions drones in that book. That's how far ahead he was. He was talking about drones in the 90s. I mean,
yeah.
He was so great. He really had a vision. I think it's easy to treat like the Oregon Files as, wow, this is just slapdash adventure and just a bunch of stuff. But he saw things. He really saw things. He had vision. He had vision. And he created an amazing world and amazing characters. And really, one of the primary characters, of course, is the Oregon itself. I mean, on the face of it, it's like, well, this is kind of way too incredulous. But if you think about it, a ship that looks like a broken down wreck really can go anywhere. And if it's full of all kinds of awesome spy gear and weapons to defend itself, I mean, why wouldn't you do that? And of course, you know, the Q ships from World War One. I mean, this is not a new concept. It has been done before.
Right.
And certainly the old Russian trawlers during the Cold War days, right? The fishing trawlers, which were not fishing. They were all just nothing but loaded with spy
Wasn't
gear.
Wasn't there something in the news the other day about the beluga whale or the white whale that's a Russian spy thing? And I didn't read it to see if it was an actual whale or a faux whale.
I think it was a beluga whale in that case.
It was an actual whale, but it was wired up or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they've used, dolphins have been used by different countries.
Right.
Everything from blowing things up to carrying equipment. I mean, yeah, I mean, the irony of the whole drone technology is you're trying to find out a way basically to do what nature already does. So, you know, you have bird drones, right? Drones that look just like birds. Well, why not just wire up a bird? And so there is, you know, biomimicry is the gold standard in drone technology. If you can make a drone fly like a bird or swim like a
or
fish.
Or a bug.
Or a bug.
Yeah.
Or fill in the blank. Well, more and more, they're finding ways to actually control animals now through technology. Because why try to invent articulating limbs and joints and ligaments when nature has already given that to you? So if you can just sort of tap into their whatever level of cortex they have, put it on a controller or an iPhone, off you go. And so more and more of that technology now is coming on board.
So we proceed from the high mountains of Tajikistan, which are right up there by the Himalayas, to the Amazon. So it's huge drop in, you know, obviously these guys are in incredibly good condition since they can race up and down altitudes.
Well, yeah, now, different groups of people in that particular sense. But, you know, as long as you have bubble gum, right, you adjust for the altitude changes. Mm-hmm. Again, one of the challenges for me as a writer is taking readers to places maybe they haven't gone, or if they've been there before, because Amazon has been done before, mm-hmm. to take them there in a new way or for a new reason.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, a hallmark of the Oregon Files franchise is to go to a number of places. And one of the ways that I was able to do that in this particular novel is splitting the team up, which is fun. So some of the team is over on this side of the planet, the other half is on this side. And that way I get to go to more places without, again, straining credulity, right? You're not, it's not the Oregon going to all over the globe several times. So trying to keep it as real as possible in my wonderful fiction world, but trying to give as much variety and difference. Like, just like I said, high mountains, jungle basin, and everything in between.
So there's a fair amount of biology in this book also. We don't want to really give much away, but in order to make this book work, there's a reason they go to the Amazon.
Absolutely. Every book, when I start, I always start with a theme. What's the thing that most seizes my imagination, that grabs my soul? And I have the opening quote in the book, which is no big giveaway, but Yuval Noah Harari, I don't know if you know him, he's a philosopher, he's associated with the World Economic Forum, but he's a thinker. And he has this quote that says, history began when men invented gods, and history will end when men become gods. And that's really the animating energy behind the transhumanist movement. And the transhumanists are people who say, look at evolution and look where we are. Human beings have now perfected the ability to hurt each other and kill the planet. And so the transhumanists are saying, huh, can we rethink this? So as Richard Dawkins would describe it, blind, pitiless nature has been sort of driving this bus for some time now. And the transhumanists are saying, hey, wait a minute. Human beings now are conscious, perhaps the only truly conscious beings in certainly our planet, if not the universe that we know of. So we are now nature's conscience. We're the conscience of nature. So let's have blind, pitiless nature step aside. We'll stomp on the accelerator and go from evolution to revolution. So back to Harari's statement, you know, history will end when men become gods. Well, what's a god? God is someone who has all knowledge, all power, has autonomy. Men, humans don't tell him what to do. Well, the promise of transhumanism, and by the way, and immoral, the promise of transhumanism is through biological means like CRISPR technologies, gene editing, we can get rid of diseases, make people stronger, make people live longer, and in fact, live forever. So someone like Ray Kurzweil is swallowing I don't know how many hundreds of dollars of vitamins every day because he wants to live long enough that there will not only be the singularity where computers achieve consciousness, but he wants to live to the point where now he can upload his consciousness into the cloud. So in Christian theology, right, Christ is coming back in the clouds. Well, now the transhumans are sending us into the cloud. It's a kind of quasi-religious sentiment that we can overcome death, pain, suffering if we have the right technologies that change all that in our bodies. And again, if we can upload our, whatever it means to be human, into the cloud, then we can just sort of keep building bodies, download into those. They'll be cool and awesome, whatever kind of avatar you want, run around, change it out, swap it out, put new tires on it, or get a whole new one, and then upload stuff back in the cloud. It's, I know it sounds crazy, but this is really what's driving an awful lot of science right now. So, you know, the future of warfare is probably not, is not going to be battleships and tanks. It's going to be, it's biotechnology. Biotechnology is the cutting edge of really science and industry across the board, but especially the military stuff. So I really wanted to address some of that. And all of my villains are a variation of that theme of how can we be smarter, faster, stronger through science, and what does that mean? What are the implications of that? What's it mean to be a human when you are merged with the machine? What's it mean to have consciousness or joy or happiness when basically now your brain is completely integrated in the internet and you have all knowledge of everybody else? And boy, would that be a lot of noise. But imagine if you're ChatGPT, or y'all following that conversation. Well, imagine if that was in here all the time. And that's what they're trying to do. You know, first it's going to be wearable, then it's going to be implantable. Neuralink, Elon Musk, his, where they're planting the electrodes in the brain, the FDA just approved human trials. I mean, it's common. What we thought drones were 10 years ago, this transhumanist technology will be 10 years from now. No question.
Well, there's certainly some huge debates going on over it about AI and ChatGPT, and, you know, and there are awful neuro diseases like epilepsy and all that, you know, implants can control. Or, and what did you see the thing about the guy who has been paralyzed and they gave him, I'm trying to remember how they did it, but anyway, well, they did enough implants so that he could walk again on his own, even though his spine. So what they're hoping, I think, is to repair severed spinal cords. And you know, that would be remarkable because
absolutely. And if they can't do that, they can put you into basically an exoskeleton,
exactly.
And so you can think and have the exoskeleton take you around.
Right.
But yeah, but the better promise is, can we go around the bad wiring if you have a broken spinal cord and still get
well,
to?
It's the electrical system that goes wonky when stuff like that happens. The transmission inside the people. So if they can figure out a wiring issue,
absolutely,
you know, they can, you can do that. I met George Reeves, you know, who was in New York one night, and I had had I have a paralyzed leg that I'm not ever going to really be able to use, and my sister, who was running this big show at the Museum of Modern Art, and said that I should go over and talk to him because we had something in common. So I felt like an idiot, as anybody would. But I did go over and talk to him. And, you know, he really wanted to stay alive and be part of trying to come up with a way to resolve what had happened to him. Unfortunately, it was a simple thing. It was an infected bedsore that killed him. You know, it wasn't the spinal injury, but I'm seeing Christopher Reeve. Thank you, Patrick. Yeah, what did I say? Oh.
Still a Superman.
Okay, no, it was Christopher. Yeah. Exactly. You know, but and I know, you know, how much he wanted to be part of trying to build a technology to overcome the human problem. And, you know, there are animals that can regenerate limbs.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so the question is if they can do it. One of the things I think is really amazing is what different species can see. There was a great series by the British film guy whose name is escaping me. But anyway.
Attenborough?
Yeah. David Attenborough, and he did a thing where using, you know, infrared or whatever all he did, he could show you what some birds and fish and other things, and they don't see like we do. You know, it's completely different. Or I watch my puppies, you know, who somehow or other can sense that the UPS truck is down over here, and if they get to the door fast enough, maybe they can savage the driver. Whereas, you know, I don't have any idea that the truck is there because I haven't heard it yet. So there's something, you know, senses they have that we don't have.
Well, that's the promise of this
and
technology.
And that's evolution, is that, you know, things have evolved with different, you know.
Right. And what this technology suggestion is, why should only dogs have super hearing?
Right.
You know, why should these animals be the ones that run so fast or go through the list? So they're... In one sense, there is a great promise. So, for example, sickle cell anemia now is being addressed through CRISPR technology.
Is it?
So there's some wonderful, wonderful possible applications. And if I were a wonderful and nice person, I would write about those. But I write action novels with villains, so there's also a dark side to these things. So why not have a soldier that can run... and jump and shoot and fly and swim faster than anybody else? And wouldn't you like an army of super soldiers that could outperform anyone else in the battlefield, that never tire, that are completely jacked into, you know, your local net, so they're all in communication with each other? And that is those are technologies that are being investigated right now. So I use the platform of biologically enhanced super mercenaries, as they're referred to, or super mercs. But that technology is definitely out there and being experimented with. And trust me, the ones who are bound by ethical requirements, whether self-imposed or legally, are staying within the bounds. But there are people out there who don't. And they're pushing those boundaries as hard as they can every single day. And it's going to change the way we live, for good and for ill.
I'm not taking that many vitamins. I'm not sure I want to survive for this brave new world, but we'll see how it goes. So you do have an actual conflict going on here between, there's a Saudi prince with his ambitions, and naturally if there's a Saudi, there's probably an Israeli somewhere in the picture.
Well, it's amazing. Yes, when you go to the Middle East, the same characters come back. And again, as a writer, the challenge is you always want to bring something new to the table. But on the other hand, people want to explore and discuss, you know, events that are really going on. So there's a tension there. You know, the golden rule for a writer is to reach the level of the uniquely familiar. When you pick up an Oregon Files book, including this one, all the things that you love about the Oregon Files that Clive Cussler invented, not me, things like the Oregon itself, are going to be there. And I love the franchise. I deeply respect the franchise. I enjoy reading the books myself. I'm a fan first and a reader, then I'm a writer. But having said that, as a writer, what can I bring to this? If I just tell you the same story that Boyd Morrison told you or Jack DeBrule told you, you're going to say, not very imaginative. I've seen this before. No, thank you. So I've got to bring, if I'm going to bring a familiar conflict like the Middle East, sidebar, why would I do that, right? Middle East, old news, every book's about that. Well, one of the things I want to discuss was the Yemeni civil war, which most Americans aren't aware of. Over 4 million people displaced, over 300,000 people slaughtered, arguably the greatest humanitarian crisis of the last several years. And no one talks about it because it's just not convenient. And the Saudis are doing that. The Houthis nominally are Iranian allies. And so we support the Saudis because that's how we, you know, it's a proxy, in other words, it's a proxy war. Does that sound familiar to you? So it's a proxy war where people are suffering by the millions, tens of thousands of children starving to death because of this war. So for me, yes, I want to tell a good story. I want you to get excited. I want you to have fun. But this is where I get to tell the truth again. So I'm bringing to your attention this particular conflict. So yes, I've got a fanatical Saudi prince whose desperate desire is to become king of Saudi Arabia. He is animated by his hatred of Israel. He's animated by his hatred of the United States. He's even animated by his hatred of other Muslims who don't share his particular brand of Islam.
And his own family.
Well, if they don't line up, absolutely. And so this is a man who wants to be king, right? And what's a king? Someone who's all-powerful and no one can tell him what to do, right? It's another aspect of that transhumanist thing. You know, God's in their own minds. I get to do whatever I want. I can take lives. I can give life. I'm in charge.
And there are several on the world stage right now as we speak, actual people doing that, right?
There always are.
I know.
That's
the moment we seem to have a particularly bumper crop. Well, it's not just Hitler. You know, we have Putin, we have Erdogan, we have Orban, we have Xi. You know, there's a whole, and let's not leave out the United States. So, you know, there's a lot of them out there.
There's a lot of suffering in the world. And
Prince, what's his, Mohammed, whatever the Saudi guy is.
Prince Khalid is usually said, yeah. So he represents a lot of those kinds of ambitions that aren't based on, you know, what you hope for in a great king or a great politician, right, is they use their power to benefit their people. But unfortunately, most people who get power, as Lord Acton tells us, right, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, oldest cliche in the world. Unfortunately, cliches are true. Mm-hmm. And so when someone like a Khalid gets power or thinks he's going to get power, there's nothing that will stop them from doing the self-aggrandizing things that make people suffer. So much of the suffering in the world today is because of the ambitions of people like that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Just a few of them.
Yeah. There is enough food in the world to feed everybody. There's no reason for most of the wars that are going on. There's no reason for the economic inequality that's going on other than greed and ambition. And so... yes, I love what I do. I love having fun with what I do, but these issues matter very deeply to me. And so I want to bring them to the fore. So yes, I absolutely have my evil Saudi. I also have an Israeli. I'm sure most of you are aware that in the 1990s, Operation Solomon happened. And that's when Ethiopian Jews were about to be slaughtered in a civil war. The Israelis surprised everybody by flying in airplanes and evacuating thousands of them within a few days. Excuse me. So one of my main characters, actually technically two of them, are Ethiopian Israelis. So you haven't seen that before very often in a novel. So not trying to be too cute by half, but at least saying, hey, this is a variation of, you know, of reality. So yeah. So and then I have my mercenaries. We've seen mercenaries in these stories before. But Jean-Paul Salan is a different kind of mercenary, I think, in part because he's deploying biologically enhanced super mercenaries. And he is the kind of guy who says, you know, my nationality is money. And it's the hatred of money that's the root of all stupidity. Because money is power, right? Money is independence. You can't tell me what to do if I have enough money. So he is doing what he does because he's completely amoral, because all he cares about is cash and power and independence. So my evil prince has hired an evil mercenary to do something amazingly evil, that basically is pointing the United States. My fanatical Saudi prince is trying to embroil the United States in a cataclysmic war with Iran. That's the essential conflict. And then everything else sort of revolves around that.
So remind me, because Clive set up, you know, these different things, the Oregon group and NUMA, which, you know, they're quasi, what kind of agencies are they? Who are the Oregon people actually responsible to? They have to get funding and be responsible somehow to somebody.
Well, you know.
Or maybe not.
Clive really set that up very well.
Yes, he did.
Almost all of them are former CIA or military. So they're all patriotic. They're not going to ever do anything that hurts the interests of the United States, which I love that. But they're an independent organization. The impolite word is they're mercenaries. I mean, they are mercenaries. But
so are they like the Wagner Group in a way?
In one sense only, that they fight for pay. And usually it's Langston Overholt IV, who's their liaison with the CIA. If the CIA needs something done that needs to be done without anyone knowing about it, they call the Oregon. But they will also take jobs on their own that pay really well. So most of their income comes from the jobs that they're generating. It's not that they're on government salary per se, because they're off the
books. No, I knew that. But I mean, yeah. If you read enough thrillers or action adventure books like this, the CIA seems to have any number of off the books operations. There's the campus in the
absolutely.
Right, you know,
yeah, I know.
And there's Sigma Force, you know, for Jim Rollins and Brad Thor. I'm trying to remember what his group is. And, you know, to write these things, you do have to sort of create some kind of an organization that has some kind of affiliation. And because we're Americans, they generally are patriotic, as you say, or
sure.
there to defend U.S. interests.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as a device, it makes a lot of sense, because if they're working for the U.S. government, then there's oversight and there's legalities and there's budgets and there's all kinds of things you can avoid. Now, if we're going to go back to the reality side of the equation, there are plenty of off-the-books operations taking place by the U.S. government. So I think we fiction writers are doing the U.S. government a favor by inventing things like, you know, the Oregon.
I'm not sure we're inventing them. I mean, that's kind of the interesting thing. So in theory, the FBI is the super agency for internal things, just like MI5 in England. And the CIA is like MI6. It is directed outward. And so, you know, there's sometimes that's a difficult distinction. I have to tell you that the new James Patterson, because Patrick and I did his book launch this afternoon called Crosstown. It's amazing. I mean, he really nails, or he and Brendan Dubois together, he really nails an awful lot of that. It kind of rises up from the January 6th thing, but he's basically talking about Federalist Paper number 10. For those who don't know it, of the 10 papers that the authors of the Constitution wrote to try to convince the populace in 1789 to vote for the Constitution, James Madison wrote Federalist Paper number 10, in which he says that if we end up with a tyranny of minorities, then our government will fail. It requires a center, it requires a consensus. And if we have a number of tyrannical minorities, which God knows is what we've got at the moment, it won't hold up. And so Jim builds on that, and it's an interesting action book that actually has a very deep center.
Well, when you have a Department of Homeland Security today and or other instruments of the intelligence community who will say things like, if you use words like the Constitution or Jefferson, you're possibly a terrorist.
Right.
when the founding documents themselves are considered suspicious material.
Right.
Where are we?
Well, that's a really good question. Where indeed are we?
Where are we? And that's a different conversation for a different author. Mm-hmm. I have the Oregon. Mm-hmm. I have off the books guys who always do the right thing and always will do the right thing. And that's why I think honestly we read things like the Oregon.
Sure.
Because that's the one place where I can get away from the nonsense and the insanity of the front pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting time. They used to say back in the 60s, theater is dead, right? Because life is so absurd. There's no point trying to do absurd things on stage. It's getting harder and harder to be a fiction writer. The
certainly harder to be a thriller writer, that's for sure.
Yeah. You don't want to just copy the headlines, but boy. Right.
You could actually often not make stuff up that is truly as ridiculous as what's happening around us.
I don't know. They're so ridiculous. They are professionally ridiculous. They are studied ridiculous. They have think tanks that are pushing ridiculous to a whole new level. I mean, it's the singularity of stupidity. It really is. And the kinds of decisions they're making and why they're making them. I love the Federalist Papers. I got it underlined. But my latest and favorite guru is Dwight D. Eisenhower, the 4-star general during president.
Yeah.
His farewell address reads like the book of Joel in the Old Testament. It is prophetic. And he talks not only about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, and we're familiar with that one, he also talks about the tyranny of a technocratic elite.
Mm-hmm.
And you put those two together, and you run the last 30 years of American history, American foreign policy, American mistakes, through that filter, it becomes crystal clear. But I have the Oregon.
That's right.
And that's fun. And you know what?
We all want heroes, you know, in the end.
We do.
What we really want is the hero to save us. That goes all the way back to, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey and, you know, the beginning of literature. We all want a hero on a quest is what we want.
And the Odyssey and the Iliad also gave models of how we should behave. I mean, Alexander the Great imagined himself as Achilles. He did what he did because he wanted to be Achilles.
Yeah.
And speaking of heroes, one of the things I wanted to do and one of the spins I'm trying to bring to the series is Maurice. Y'all remember Maurice? Well, he has a backstory. I'll just say that. Oh. Yeah, I love Maurice. I love Maurice. You're not, Maurice is fun. So one more hero for the pantheon of the Oregon.
So I can gather from all this that you're so excited about writing these that you're probably going to write another one.
Dirk Kussler and the Kussler Estate have kindly asked me to do another one. I'm thrilled to do it.
Excellent.
I'm blessed and excited.
Okay. Well, that's really good news.
Any ideas? Oh, we'll talk later.
If you can even keep up with, you know, events as they're unfolding while you're writing them, it's an interesting idea. Or even get ahead.
Well, yeah, always. I'm always trying to get ahead.
Sure.
The conversation about Iran and Saudi Arabia, when I wrote about it, was a certain way. Have you been following the news lately?
Mm-hmm.
Since we pulled out of Afghanistan, our influence in the Middle East has collapsed. OPEC has turned its back on us. They're abandoning the dollar for the petrodollar. And suddenly Iran and who? Saudi Arabia are forming an alliance, and they've ended the Yemeni civil war, which I'm actually rather grateful for because the U.S. wasn't doing it. So, yeah, I try to get ahead of that issue. But it still caught up with me and then blew by me again. So it's hard. It's really hard. Unless I'm writing science fiction in the year 3035, things are happening so fast now. It's happening so fast.
Well, I mean, the Pacific has suddenly come back into play in a very big way.
Absolutely.
You know?
No
so
question.
It's, you know, it's difficult to maintain all fronts.
Yeah. And my second drone book, third drone book, was exactly about China, South Pacific. I mean, the old issues are the new ones.
Right.
They recede again. They come back. This is the challenge. It's the same players. It's the same powers. It's the same ambitions over and over and over. And unless I want to talk about, I don't know, angry and violent bridge clubs in Tunisia, you have to keep coming back to the same players. And so I never
Maybe you could just do school board meetings.
Which have been declared terrorist events by certain elements of our government, by the way. So, Juan Cabrillo and the Intrepid Crew of the Oregon go to a school board meeting.
Scale it down.
I feel it. All right. I'll play with that.
So why don't we take questions? I think we're moving towards the absurd here. Do any of you have questions that you would like to ask Mike?
answered one that I was really interested in, and you asked it, and that was, is he going to write a third book about the Lord?
Lord willing. Thank you.
Well, no,
that's very encouraging.
The Custer estate is willing. The question is, you know, are you up for it?
I'm willing. Yeah, it's just like it's like Dirk, who's just great. I mean, the whole family's been so kind to me and welcoming. Like all the Custer fans have been extraordinarily generous. I mean, this is a storied franchise, and you talk about you don't want to drop that ball. But it's a little bit like, you know, now King Charles saying, hey, would you like to add a few lines to the St. Crispin's Day speech in Macbeth? You know, just toss a few more lines there that way. See what you can do. So, you know, it's always, it's, I remember Hemingway, he said, every time he starts a new book, he has to learn how to write all over again. And the first time he said that, I thought, well, that's dumb. You know, he writes lots of books. No, he's right. I mean, you really have to relearn it all over again, really re-embrace it. I want to, because it's always going to be fresh. It's going to be exciting for me. I have to be captivated. I have to be freaking out. I have to be cheering. And if I'm not, you aren't. So to me, it's, you know, it's an adventure. It really is. As a human being, it's an adventure for me. As a writer, it's an adventure for me. But it also means it's a challenge, because I've got to find something that will captivate you as well. Because
probably not a school board meeting, right? Shoot, man. Sorry.
Well, we tried, but that's a good start. But right, you tried 99 ideas to get to the 100. So, school board, not so much.
Well, so kind of building on all of this, you know, things like the Oregon Files. It seems like whatever period of time it takes you to write one, by the time it's published, it's really relevant, you know. And you've talked about how there are so many things going on that, you know, we don't necessarily hear about in the news. So how do you do your research? How do you sift through all of this stuff all day, every day? And, you know, what's happening right now? You talked about some of the, you know, the technologies that are developing, all the transhumanism. How do you sort things out and kind of focus in on a plot that actually works?
That's a great question. Everything I ever learned about life, I learned from the Oregon Files. So there's a device on the Oregon Files called the Sniffer, where basically it hoovers every bit of electromagnetic data out of the atmosphere, monitors everything. I got a sniffer. I'm just a sniffer. I'm constantly hoovering this stuff up. It can be a distraction. Writers who don't want to write today will say, oh, I'll just do research. No, you got to write every day, right? You got to stay to it. But you also have to stay current. You have to stay with it. You really do. The danger is that you're just now a news service. You're, like I say, jotting down facts. That's not a story. What makes it easy for me, in one sense, is Clive Cussler has built this amazing world. Juan Cabrillo. Anybody like Juan Cabrillo? Are you fans of Juan Cabrillo? Yeah. Go through the list of characters. He's created these great characters. You've got this awesome ship. I mean, it's basically, I like the summary, that the Oregon Files is basically Star Trek, the Enterprise, right? The original series. Let's get serious here. It's the Enterprise married to Mission Impossible, the original series, right? So it's big technology, but big action with lots of characters. And it's a beautiful formula. It's a beautiful framework. So in that sense, it's easy. But now I got to do it in a way that hasn't been done before, that's also interesting and relevant. So that's my challenge. And I'm blessed to have that challenge. But yeah, it's a challenge. It really is. What kills me is, this happened to me last book even, and well, maybe I had this idea. I was so in love with this idea. It was the greatest idea ever, the best idea I ever had in my life. I nailed it. I crushed it. Oh boy. Oh boy. Here, I finally made it. Wrote it up, did the outline, did the research, had it footnoted. I sent it to Dirk. And it's that wonderful email. He says, this is a fantastic idea. But Graham Brown just wrote it. So Graham Brown, I'm watching you, buddy. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I say great minds think alike, but he thought it first, so I'm less great.
He gets to win, right? Yeah, unfortunately.
So
Graham
again,
will be here, by the way, on September 8th. Okay. And Dirk will be here on November 11th. So there's a new Graham Brown in September, and then there's a new Dirk Pitt. And we're doing it on a Saturday because we thought that people could find it easier to travel if we did a Saturday night with Dirk. So
on top of everything else, those geniuses are out there writing, doing the same thing. And so then to not collide into what they're doing. But that's what Dirk does. Dirk oversees the entire series.
He took on that role.
Yeah, it's amazing how he keeps them all straight. But he's the one that superintends it all so that we don't step on each other's toes or cross wires.
I know. And he really likes doing that. But I keep saying to him, I can't even imagine a Dirk Pitt that isn't written by Dirk Kessler. I mean, it would be, you know.
I agree.
But it is, you know, these books are so big. I'll never forget Clive sitting down with me when he finished Trojan Odyssey and saying the scope of the books and the technology and all had become too big for him to do them all by himself. And, you know, it really is for a younger guy, because he was in his 70s by then when he said that. It's a huge amount of work.
It's some heavy lifting for sure. But again, it's a privilege. It's an honor. And that's what I do. And if I wasn't writing these books, I'd still would be reading the same things and, well, reading Clive Cussler novels. So if I'm going to read them, I might as well write them.
That's an excellent idea. Anybody, Patrick, is there anything from the virtual audience?
For a topic standpoint on that third book, today in the Wall Street Journal, they talked about Japan taking quantum computing to AI, taking AI to quantum computing in a really big way. Taking that and nanotechnology could really create something amazing. About a year ago here in Arizona at the Commerce Authority, I was at a meeting. DARPA was there, and they were talking about many of the things you talked about earlier in your book.
Well, and I love the topic of artificial general intelligence. I love the idea of organoid general intelligence, which is the next level, using literally brain cells because they're far more efficient and better than computer chips. I love the idea of computer sentience. I love the idea of applying all of this, you know, of software that is irresistible and can't be stopped, which is one of the promises of quantum computing. Unfortunately, The Jungle by Jack DeBrule and Shadow Tyrants both have quantum computing, artificial intelligence, unstoppable software. They've done it. And this is from years ago. Jack DeBrule. So
it's not really impossible for readers to accept the idea that you could write something with your own spin on a same topic.
Done better.
There are only so many things out there, actually.
Yeah, but what's so interesting about this universe is, like I said, my predecessors had incredible imaginations and incredible plots. And basically, in both their cases, their machines could take over everything, everywhere. You can't stop them. Well, everything, everywhere covers a lot of ground. So if I grab this smaller plot and make it and blow it up, you know, would you be forgiving of that? Or would you say, I've read this before? So it's a challenge. It's a real challenge.
Patrick, is there anything?
Yeah. What about a cross-pollination between some of the different series? Is that kind of off the table? Like, say, you and Graham or you and one of the other authors. Maybe, like, all four, you know, collaborated on a story.
Well, I don't know that...
That's splitting the advance three ways, though. That might not be good.
That's another conversation. First of all... those guys are stallions. I'm the donkey, so they may not want to pair up with me, number one. Number two, there is a little cross-pollination. Every now and then, Dirk Pitt will show up in an Oregon Files novel. It's not for very much. It's usually a kind of an appearance. But you have to set it up and work it in there. That's definitely doable. I don't know how fans overall would feel about that, because if you merge all of them, then it is kind of a big, there's this new trend in cooking now, my wife tells me, because she's an amazing chef, like just three ingredients to make a fabulous thing. And she does it, and it, well, it's fabulous. Sometimes less is more. So maybe having too many characters and too many franchises, maybe it wouldn't work. But yeah, we're all open for anything. We love new ideas, and I think they all be up for
it. That's an interesting question for you readers. You know, do you read all of the Kessler books, or do you focus on, let's say, the Oregon Files, or you read Numa? I'm just
Mine
wondering.
Too. I love
yeah.
Them.
Well, that's why you're here, and that's wonderful.
Oh, you're right. You're exactly right. Yeah.
This definitely is a James Bond thing when he goes to.
Oh, absolutely.
Now that Clive is not with us, there is a better chance for a movie. Right. I don't know, but it's a question we can talk to Dirk about in November, because it would all go through Dirk and the Sandecker. Is the holding group for all of that.
And I'll tell you what, and that's a great question.
You could do that. What fun.
It'll be fun. It'd also be a great TV series. You know, think of Game of Thrones or those really big ones. Jack Ryan, yeah.
No, there's the new Jack Ryan, and my poor husband, who's had cervical spine surgery and can't do, I mean, he's just like immobile. He's binged Game of Thrones. I'm so tired. I never watched it. And as I go back and forth through the house, Game of Thrones is flickering. And I finally said to him, is it ever going to be over? I mean, I had no idea
how long it was.
that you're using franchise again, right?
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Wow.
You know, so Game of Thrones meets the Oregon Files. Yeah.
Right.
Peter Dinklage, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when a question about kind of the challenges of sort of adapting your own style to the Clive Cussler franchise. I remember, Barbara, remember when Tom Perry took on the series for a couple, or was it the same series?
He was writing the Fargo series.
Yeah. Anyway, I remember him saying that one of the revelations of working with Clive was this notion of make it fun, make it more fun. And he was like, interesting. Never occurred, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, Tom's more intellectual writer.
But I think it had an effect on his writing,
yeah.
His own writing.
Now, you know, Clive actually lived the life that these characters do. When his 80th birthday, we put together this amazing film. I mean, you know, the family gave it. I actually have it. Maybe we should show it when Dirk is here. I have it on a... you know, whatever they are.
A brain implant?
A stick. You know, those little, yeah.
A what?
The little things you...
What is this analog thing of which you speak?
Thumb drive, right?
Thumb drive.
Thank you. That's it. I couldn't think of the word. Right. James Patterson revealed to me today it's the same problem I do. Neither one of us can remember names. It isn't that we're brain deficient. It's just that part of the retrieval system is whirring away. Anyway, one of the things that was so wonderful about Clive is that he actually did all that stuff, you know, to the degree that, you know, it was possible. I mean, by the time some of this really hair-raising stuff came along, he really wasn't physically able to do it. But, you know, I've always thought it was so great that he could transfer adventure, you know, back and forth. He could live it, and then he could write it. That's probably why he did such a great job imagining these worlds.
Yeah, I'm of an age when I think writer in my mind, Clive Cussler is absolutely one of the ones that come to the top, because, like you said, he lived the life. You know, what as a young boy, what I imagined an adventure writer was like a Clive Cussler, who's actually diving and finding wrecks and running around.
He's in that line of H. Rider Haggard. You know, when I was a kid, King Solomon's Mines got with Stuart Granger and Deborah Carr, who had a phenomenal hairdo in the middle of the African jungle. But anyway, that was really exciting stuff. Errol Flynn, you know, Robin Scarrow and all the right. And so there's a tradition of that kind of thing. But yeah. Clive took it up to a different level. And once he stopped writing the Dirk Pitts all by himself, then he was able to branch out and, you know, create these other worlds as long as there were people to work with him.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was, I've always admired the fact that he understood where he was, you know, he understood what he could do, what his limits were, and what he could do if he didn't have to, if he could expand it by bringing in other people. And that was a real gamble for him.
Well, and also setting aside his ego. I mean, you know, most writers are so precious about their work and what they've created. Yeah, and
Clive was not ego at all.
See?
No, he was all in service of the story, always.
In my limited experience, I've been around a number of creatives in my life, different kinds of professions. The more jealous and angry and possessive they are, the less talent they have. The really talented people always give it away, always let go, in part because they know they've got more. You know, they're not trying to prove themselves or find worth or meaning or purpose in the fact that, you know, you love what I'm doing. They love what they're doing, and we love reading about it. That's the difference. And so, yeah, Clive is one of those one-of-a-kind people that happen, you know, in a generation. Most writers will never rise up to that level. And, you know, to get one book maybe on the New York Times, that's kind of a miracle. To create a series that gets on the New York Times, to create five series, I mean, that's, what a legacy. What an incredible legacy.
Well, in that case, Mike, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks
it's really been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.